From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. This episode, the farm bill means major cuts to food stamps.
That would be really tough. I mean, we would maybe be able to last on 2 weeks if we stretched it.
The murky world of Chinese mistresses.
It's not pure empowerment. It's not pure victimization or exploitation. It's somewhere in between.
And the man who might have inspired the Academy Award statuette.
He had this very athletic build. I mean, he looked just like Oscar.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. Last month, President Obama made a special trip to Michigan to sign the Farm Bill, finally passed after 2 years of disagreement in Congress. One important clause, set to take effect this month, is a major cut to food stamps. The Congressional Budget Office has estimated the cuts would affect about 850,000 households, saving about $8.5 billion over the next 10 years. That cut was achieved by closing what some see as a loophole regarding who qualifies for the program. Craig LaMolt of member station WSHU reports at least two states are trying to rescue funding by opening that loophole back up.
Patricia Stewart of New Haven visited a food pantry this week for some help with her groceries. She gets $189 a month in food stamps. When the farm bill passed, it meant Stewart was due for a cut.
I really don't know how I would have been able to purchase, you know, things that I need, that I'm one person. So God forbid people with children.
But Connecticut's Democratic Governor Daniel Malloy managed to stop that cut in food stamps, benefits that are provided by a federal program called SNAP. Stewart says she wants to give him a hug.
Tell him thank you, because, you know, it's hard. It's really hard.
To understand just how the governor managed to stop the cut, you need to understand a little about how the state is maximizing the amount of food stamps people like Stewart are getting. It turns out the federal government gives more in SNAP benefits to people if they also qualify for a state-administered program to help pay for heating their homes. But not every food stamp household pays a heating bill. For many, it's included in rent. What Connecticut's been doing is to give households like that the hefty sum of $1 a year in heating assistance, just so they'll qualify for the boost in federal SNAP benefits. And Connecticut isn't alone. At least 14 other so-called heat and eat states are doing the same thing. The Farm Bill sought to stop that practice by saying people can only get the extra SNAP money if they're getting at least $20 a year in heating assistance. So here's what Governor Malloy decided to do.
Our minimum benefit will now be $20.01. It is technically within the legislation, and it is in the spirit of the legislation.
Malloy says that's because they're just trying to keep providing the help that people need, with less and less coming from the federal government. He says it's not cheating the system, since they're meeting the requirements in the Farm Bill.
I mean, they gave us a roadmap, and I'm following it.
This week, New York's Democratic Governor Andrew Cuomo followed that roadmap, too, and wound up in the same place. By boosting home heating assistance, Cuomo says he's preserving $457 million in federal SNAP benefits for nearly 300,000 households. Of course, not everybody's thrilled that the cuts are being restored. Rachel Sheffield is a policy analyst with the Conservative Heritage Foundation. She says the whole SNAP program needs to be reformed. And at the very least, states like Connecticut and New York shouldn't be allowed to exploit the program.
This is basically, you know, a scheme that the states are using. It's a loophole, and it is permissible technically by law, but it's something that, you know, states have found that they can use to pull down more federal dollars. You know, over the years, states have paid less and less into welfare programs. And so, you know, again, there's really no accountability on their part for how much is being spent on this program.
Connecticut Governor Malloy says he's not exploiting anything.
I think we're taking the appropriate steps to make sure that our children are fed, that our families are intact, that we continue to see struggling families get the aid that they need, in spite of Republicans in the Congress.
Malloy says he suspects a number of governors, mostly Democrats, will follow his example. For NPR News, I'm Craig LaMolt in Connecticut.
In fact, most of those 15 or so states that use the heat and eat loophole have Democratic governors. Along with New York and Connecticut are the likes of California, Massachusetts, and Oregon. More than 20% of Oregonians are on food stamps. That's one of the highest rates in the country. These new cuts would affect over 140,000 people there. On average, they'd lose about $58 a month. That comes on the heels of a nationwide cut back in November. Congress had boosted food stamps during the recession as part of the economic stimulus, but that expired on November 1st. In Oregon, families lost about $36 a month. That might not sound like much, but Judy Alley says it is. She runs a food bank in Portland.
We saw an immediate increase.
Her food bank helps thousands of people a month, but she knew something was up less than a week into November when dozens of people asked her why their checks were smaller.
There was no preparation time, and for people who are living hand-to-mouth day-to-day, there was no way for them to compensate or adjust for this. So more people ended up going to our pantry and others. I've heard anecdotally, you know, throughout the state that we're not atypical. This is what happened all around.
Allie says her food bank has had to cut back on the amount of food that people are allowed to take and limit their choices. To stretch resources, she says families can only use her food bank 6 times in a calendar year. Here's what she says is worrying her. It's just March 1st, but some people have already hit that limit. She says it's hard to turn people away. She's already made some exceptions.
But I don't know that we can afford to do it all the time because we don't have enough food.
If the cuts hold in Oregon, the Oregon Food Bank predicts their distribution would have to rise by 44.5 million pounds of food, an increase of 50%. One of those hundreds of thousands of Oregonians on food stamps is a woman named Carly Poe. She's 33 years old, and it's just her and her 14-year-old son at home. In November, her food stamp check shrunk by about a third.
It became a really big issue with trying to balance paying bills and paying for food. Sometimes we would just use bill money for food because we run out of food stamps so fast.
It's important to Carly for her and her son to eat some fresh produce, but she says it's hard to afford that now. There's more frozen food and canned goods around the house. And if she were to lose another $60 a month...
That would be really tough. I mean, we would maybe be able to last on 2 weeks if we stretched it. I don't know what else we're going to do.
Carly doesn't use food banks right now. She tries to stretch her dollars at the grocery store. But if the cuts hold, Carly and thousands of other families in the country may have to turn to other ways to feed their families. If you're just joining us, it's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. It's hard to avoid the public service announcements about sex trafficking in America. They're plastered on buses and billboards, images of young women trapped and exploited, and a hotline to call for help.
Human trafficking generates $32 billion a year. The average age of victims sold into slavery is 12 to 14.
The numbers are staggering. The Justice Department estimates that each year, at least 200,000 children are trafficked for sex in America. But when the law gets involved, teens get arrested on prostitution charges, and victims are treated as criminals. That's our cover story today. And a heads up to parents, this is going to be an adult conversation. It's a stunning contradiction in the law. Girls who are too young to legally consent to sex being prosecuted for selling sex. Amy Farrell is an expert who studies sex trafficking legislation, and she says some states are trying to fix the problem through what are called safe harbor laws.
The safe harbor legislation that has been passed in 12 states states that children should not be prosecuted for prostitution because children are too young to consent for sex. Depending on the age range of statutory rape laws, those ranged between 14, 16, and 18 in most states. So you have this kind of strange period of time where children could still be charged with prostitution offenses, even when they might have been a victim in a statutory rape situation.
Can you talk about safe haven laws and what they are and where they've been instituted?
Right. So there are 12 states that have passed safe haven, safe harbor. They sort of have different names, legislation. And the basic premise of them is that for minors that are prostituted, the police will either not be allowed to make arrests, or if they make arrests, prosecutors have the ability to divert those children out of a juvenile delinquency proceeding. and instead put them in what we call a child in need proceeding. New York has probably one of the most comprehensive safe harbor laws. Massachusetts, Illinois, Florida. There are a few states that are doing this specifically with children. Washington, D.C., for example, has a court. And basically, that it has been a whole series of individual judges seeing these cases coming through their courts and becoming passionate and involved on the issue and being willing to work with prosecutors, the defense bar, and service providers to establish these problem-solving courts.
In California, there is no safe haven law. Minors can be and are prosecuted for prostitution. But here in Los Angeles County, one judge has set up a special juvenile court to help victims of sex trafficking. We went to visit the court's founder and judge, Catherine Pratt, at the towering federal court building in Compton.
12th floor.
Pratt meets me on the 12th floor of the aging high-rise.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Likewise.
Come on back. I don't know why you're using my house key to get in. It's been a rough few weeks.
A rough few years because Pratt has been consumed by her work, helping young victims of sex trafficking get treated as just that, victims. In a typical juvenile court, young women who are picked up for prostitution are sometimes sentenced to juvenile detention or forced to testify in exchange for a plea deal. Judge Pratt told me about a case that haunts her and convinced her the system was broken.
We had one girl who was asked to testify in a case against her pimp and trafficker. She was 15 at the time that she testified. And the incident for which they were being prosecuted was an incident where she was drugged to the point of having lost consciousness. And then she was gang raped by five men, and it was videotaped. She was in an adult court, which meant it was open to the public. There were five defendants there. All of them had family members and gang members there to support them. And the district attorney asked her to view the videotape that she had never seen and identify the men involved. And that was her role in testifying. It was a devastating experience for her. And she has struggled ever since then. I feel like we did a very poor job of protecting her from that and preparing her for that. And it's one of the lessons that I learned about how to work with these kids and how not to work with these kids.
Pratt tells me she set out to create a court that would protect girls from trauma at the hands of the justice system and focus on rehabilitation instead of punishment. Girls in her court are placed into special group homes with trauma counselors and sexual education resources. And in general, the girls aren't compelled to testify against their abusers. Pratt tells me it's all about gaining trust.
I will tell you that when you first meet some of these kids, they are pretty off-putting. They are hard. They can be combative. They have these levels of trauma that prevent them from really making connections with people.
To help victims of sex trafficking make those connections with trusted adults, her court works with nonprofit groups where adult survivors of sex trafficking work as mentors.
My name's Christina Fitz, and I am a mentor survivor advocate with Saving Innocence nonprofit organization.
Fitz is a mentor to 25 girls in Pratt's court. She meets with each one for 3 hours a week for one-on-one counseling. They have her cell number. If something happens, day or night, she's the first one they call. She told me the kids look up to her because she knows what they've been through. Fitz herself was a victim of sex trafficking for more than 3 years.
I'm like a support system to them, so if they want to talk about certain issues that they can't really talk about or they don't have anybody to talk to at a group home or with their foster family, then they can come to me. I take them out on trips. I try to get them out of their communities so that they can see that there's other things in life besides just working and being exploited through prostitution.
When I spoke with Christina Fitz, I saw a woman who had come through that experience with a strong desire to guide other young women. One of the things she teaches young girls is how to recognize men who will exploit them.
There are instances where they might meet a guy, and we call this guy the Prince Charming guy, and he manipulates them, makes them feel love, and he makes sure that all the needs and the wants, getting a cell phone or their hair or their nails done, those might be little things to us adults, but to children who have never had that before, that's a big deal to them. And so it's easy to manipulate a child by giving her these simple little things. It's like giving a little kid a candy. We also teach them about sexual education, how to use a condom, different STDs. And we teach them about self-esteem, being able to speak up for themselves. And like, you know, if somebody ever was to come in contact with them and things didn't sound right, the steps that they can use to get away and just to know, like, if that's just a bad situation before they even get involved in it.
It's not just about teaching girls to recognize pimps and traffickers. It's about prosecuting those people. I asked Judge Pratt if her new approach, focusing on treatment for the girls, hurt the court's ability to prosecute the pimps and traffickers.
You know, initially when we started the program, I would have answered that question by saying that we were improving our ability to prosecute the pimps and traffickers. We were providing the kids with some support when they went and testified. But a lot of the boys who are coming out of the juvenile justice system are the ones who are becoming the pimps or traffickers. So the foster care system and juvenile justice system is creating both sides of this market, the suppliers and actually the goods.
Nationwide, pimps are prosecuted far less often than the people they exploit. And the men who buy sex from minors are very rarely prosecuted. Amy Farrell says states are beginning to change the law, stiffening the penalties for purchasing sex from a child.
The bigger problem isn't so much changing the laws. We're starting to do that to make these more serious crimes. The real challenge will be convincing law enforcement and the judiciary to hold people who purchase sex from trafficked persons or from persons that are children accountable. And I think prosecutors are reluctant to pursue prosecution generally because it has been not politically expedient to do so in many communities.
As for the girls in Catherine Pratt's special court, Pratt says she thinks the court has been very successful. She's even working with a national organization of juvenile court judges to teach others how to work with victims of sex trafficking. Most rewarding, though, is her relationship with the girls. She shows me around her office, and it looks more like that of a beloved school principal than a judge. Framed pictures of Pratt at birthdays and graduations for the young women who have come through her court.
Next week, one of my girls who was on probation to me turns 19. So she just contacted me and said she wanted to go to dinner. So we're making plans.
The grant that funds her court runs out at the end of this year, and Pratt tells me she is not sure what will happen then. The county has said the budget cannot support the program. At the same time, cities across the country are looking at setting up similar courts for juvenile victims. How many ways are there to tell a love story? More than you may think. Ritesh Batra's film, The Lunchbox, is a story of a love that blossoms from a screwed-up food delivery.
When I was writing it and making it, you know, to me it was always a story of these two lonely souls sifting through the baggage of their lives through this connection of the misdelivered lunchbox. And a relationship begins between them through notes in the lunchbox. It truly becomes a love story.
Hello. Kal khali dabba bhejne ke liye.
Nimrit Kaur plays Ila, a young housewife. She sends a lunchbox out to her husband every day using a dabbawala, one of India's reliable lunchbox delivery men. One day, that lunchbox goes to the wrong man.
Dear Ila, the salt was fine today. The chili was a bit on a higher side.
Irfan Khan, of Life of Pi and Slumdog Millionaire, plays Sajan Fernandez, a widower just 1 month shy of retirement and longing for connection. Over time, they begin pouring out their souls through letters in the lunchbox.
I think we forget things if we have no one to tell them to.
In this relationship, the food itself conveys emotion.
When he first gets her food, she's essentially infused herself in it. And, you know, he tastes it, and that's really the sort of the beginning of their relationship.
I want to give people a sense of just the kind of the insane scale of what actually happens in Mumbai with this lunchbox delivery, because they're going from individual home to individuals and businesses. Could you explain that? Because it's kind of crazy.
They're actually 5,000 lunchbox delivery men, and they deliver hot meals from the housewives at homes to their husbands in the offices. And they use only public transport and bicycles and wheelbarrows and trains and buses. And they work in groups, so along the way, a lunchbox changes hands many times from one group to another till it reaches its destination. Back in the day, a lot of them used to be illiterate, so they've devised this coding system of numbers, letters, and colors that, you know, they all can decipher. And that's one of their big secrets to why this works. And it's a 120-year-old tradition, and, you know, they deliver thousands of lunchboxes a day. And the statistic is that only 1 in 6 million goes to the wrong address. And the movie, of course, is about that one lunchbox that goes to the wrong address.
Right, that's the dramatic incident that really triggers the dramatic action in the film. And could you explain how that happens?
The Dabbawalas, the lunchbox delivery men of Bombay, they were intimately involved with us in the film. And people always ask, you know, they have such an extraordinary success rate, so weren't they angry or mad that you were making the film about that one mistake? But, you know, in the film, we never explained the mistake. And I always told them that, you know, if something is happening 1 in 6 million times, it's a miracle, it's not a mistake. So the movie is really about the miracle.
What's amazing about the love story, well, it almost seems like a challenge you'd make for a director, that you have your two romantic leads who are really never with each other. They only communicate through these letters. You know, how did you do that with these actors, where all they have to react to are letters, not each other?
It was always such an integral part of the script that, you know, these two people would get closer together but never meet physically in the film. The actors always had, you know, I could tell when I would see them in the monitor or on set, you know, when you have a relationship with someone you've never seen, mm-hmm. as often people do with people on the internet, there is sort of flight of fantasy happening inside both the characters. Because they are imagining what this other person looks like and you know, what they would say to them when they would meet. And they each had their own secret story that, you know, I didn't want to know.
Amazing performances. You know, it's one of the things that can be disarming about India for visitors, and especially in a city like Mumbai, the way that the ancient exists alongside the modern. And that's also really running strong in this film, where the Dabbawalas, as you say, they've been going for over 100 years. But then they're communicating through letters, as one of the characters points out, in the age of the internet.
Sure. Thank you for noticing that. You know, I mean, India is that kind of a place, you know, where so many times exist together at once. We have an office in the film, actually, that was always in the script and is an actual location. And we found it quite by chance. And everything is done manually. And there's not one computer there. So all we had to do when we got into that location was embellish it with more files than it had, you know. And down the street, there might be a swanky sort of call center with computers and, you know, the modern stuff.
Where did you get this inspired idea for the Dabbawalas to inadvertently connect people romantically?
You know, I grew up in Bombay, but I moved to the States when I was 18 to study. When I was growing up, you know, my mom would send my dad a lunchbox, but I didn't think it was unique or special or interesting. Hmm. You know, when you leave and you go back, you see things that you didn't see before. Initially, I wanted to make a documentary about them, so I'd embedded myself with them for a couple of weeks. We became friends, and they started telling me these little germs of stories, you know, like so-and-so housewife, she takes too long because she tries something new every day. So I just became more interested in all those stories. So I quit the documentary, abandoned it, and started writing this.
How was the film done in India?
Well, it's been a really pleasant surprise, actually, because when we were making the film, you know, we thought, you know, it's an Indian story, of course, with sort of universal themes, and it can travel. But we never thought it would do well in India because, you know, it doesn't have songs.
Mm-hmm. Even without the songs, it's not a Bollywood romance in any... It's kind of the opposite of that.
Exactly, yeah. So we never thought it would do well in India, but, you know, India always surprises you.
Ritesh Batra is the writer and director of the film The Lunchbox. Ritesh, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
If you're just joining us, this is All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Ra. This is the voice of a man named Philippe Jaroussky. That's right, this is a man. He's a French opera singer, and this is an album of arias written in the 18th century for a castrato. In case you haven't heard of the practice, back in the day, boy singers were sometimes castrated to retain that high singing voice through adulthood.
I'm not a castrato, I'm a contratenor, but I'm singing high, we can say.
Philippe Jaroussky is still intact, as they say. He's a countertenor. He achieves that high pitch through vocal technique. Think falsetto on steroids. And because of that, he explained to me, he will never sound exactly like a real castrato.
They were sounding more brilliant than us because they were bigger. They have enormous chests.
Bigger rib cages, right? They could breathe more.
And with very small vocal cords. That was probably pretty impressive to hear. And we know that they could keep a sound for 1-2 minutes without breathing at all. Then you can imagine the impact on the audience was probably amazing. I'm not singing with my speaking voice, I'm singing with my head voice, like a soprano, a woman would do the same, actually. To sing this castrato repertory now, we have two options. We can use a female singer, of course, and we can also use a contertenor.
Let's talk about this music on this album, which is all of these songs are associated with maybe the most famous castrato.
Yes, Farinelli.
Mm-hmm.
We know that Farinelli was one of the most incredible virtuoso singer of the entire history of music. When I started to sing, I really didn't want to make a project about this castrato, particularly Farinelli, because I wanted to take distance with that. And of course, I had a lot of scores at home, and I wasn't so convinced by the music. And when I started to sing music from Nicola Porpora, composed for Farinelli, then Nicola Porpora was this Neapolitan composer who was a teacher. I really felt when I started to sing these arias, all the love that Porpora had for his most famous student. What convinced me to make a project to explain that finally this castrato voice, you know, it wasn't enough to make the operation on a child. They were training, practicing for many, many years, and they were practicing for 8 hours, 10 hours by day. They were arriving on stage at the age of, most of them, 15, 16 years old. But what I liked with this Porpora music particularly is that music wasn't based about virtuosity. I think he's respecting more Farinelli like a musician and not only a vocal monster, you know. Mm. And that's why I was convinced to make a Farinelli project finally. You know, of course, you have good critics and bad critics. And I received a bad one about this CD. And the title was that I wasn't Farinelli. And of course, I'm not. I don't want to say that I'm singing like Farinelli. That would be very pretentious. But I think the people, they need to hear this music. And, you know, when I was a student, I practiced a lot, all these technical points. But now, what it matters for me is really to sing for the audience in front of me. And the audience in front of me is a modern one.
Of all the arias on here, what's the one that you feel touches the audience?
There is one, it's probably the best aria that Porpora composed, probably for a singer in his entire life. And for me, it sounds like a farewell of Porpora for Farinelli. It's Alto Giove by Polifemo. A lot of people are touched when I'm starting with this note, this single note you have to keep. We know that the castrati, they were able to keep a note very long, to start very sweet, very pianissimo, to make a huge crescendo, and after go down. They could take a note for maybe, probably, for sure more than 1 minute, but probably Farinelli could even 2 minutes. And try to keep a note just 20 seconds, it's already something. And I explain to the people that when they say that it's impressive what I do in this note, I say, imagine that castrato was keeping this note 3 times longer than me.
What is your favorite aria from this album?
The favorite aria... There is one I like very much because it's a small, tiny thing. This is the last track of the CD. Most of the time, you finish a CD with fireworks.
Mm-hmm.
And for this album, I didn't want. I really chose this very small cavatina from Orfeo. I think this music is very touching and it's very simple. And finally, you know, the CD is ending with these last words, sono infelice, which means, of course, I'm unhappy. And then it's finished.
Philippe, thank you so much.
That was my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Philippe Jaruski is a countertenor. He's on tour right now, promoting his new album, Porpora Arias, written for the castrato Farinelli. If you're just joining us, it's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. It's happening again. Yet another massive winter storm is covering much of the central U.S. with freezing rain and snow. Thousands of flights have already been canceled across the country. Well, this would not be the case if you lived in any Nordic country. Nordic countries face brutal snow every year, and their winter lasts 5 months. But their airports almost never close. To find out their secret, we turn to Heini Noronen-Juhola. She helped devise a playbook of about 25 different kinds of plowing patterns to clear snow off the runways at Helsinki-Vanta Airport. That playbook is part of a comprehensive approach, including off-season training, fancy machines, and careful choreography. They call it snowhow.
Snowhow is more or less like the attitude towards this whole thing. We have to make sure that all that works really quickly whenever needed, and everybody is ready all the time. So that's a mindset, I'd say.
So that sounds like the coordination would be pretty complicated, that in addition, obviously, to the planes coming in and going out, a lot of big equipment that you have running almost constantly.
It's quite important to work together. The air traffic control gives slots to runways for our maintenance team. So we don't close the runways for this purpose. We will just give them slots to do the clearing.
We've heard that you consider your airport to be the world champions of snowhow. Why is that?
Well, I'd like to say that because it sounds really cool. But but in fact, when Heathrow went closed in 2010, just before Christmas, for 1 week because of snow conditions, we realized that we are doing something really well.
Is there a bit of rivalry with the Nordic countries, with more of your neighbors about who can do the better job?
Yes, it is. But it's really friendly rivalry. We are always competing, but we are, of course, the best.
When was the last time that you actually had to close the airport?
Yeah, it was in 2003, and that was for 30 minutes. And that was because we had, at the same time, snow and some air traffic control problems.
And how does that record compare with Norway?
Really well.
Heini Noronen-Juhola is the Vice President for Aviation and Safety at Helsinki-Vanta Airport. Heini, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
The 8-pound, 24-karat gold-plated statuette that will be handed out at the Academy Awards tonight is said to be modeled after a real man. That man's name is not Oscar. It might be Emilio. Emilio El Indio Fernandez, a famous Mexican director and actor who lived in Hollywood in the 1920s. Shireen Marisol Meraji from our Code Switch team has the story, which could be an urban legend.
Ask old folks in Mexico City about Emilio El Indio Fernandez. By the way, he's half Kickapoo. That's where he got the nickname El Indio, the Indian. Anyway, ask old folks in Mexico City about him, and they'll tell you they love his movies.
Pues, por ejemplo, María Candelaria o La Perla.
María Candelaria, también.
Especially María Candelaria, the movie Fernandez wrote and directed that won the top prize at the 1946 Cannes Film Festival and put Mexican films on the world stage. Now ask them about Fernandez's stint as a model for the Oscar statuette, and the answers vary. Connie Navarro and Tere Vargas are having coffee in Mexico City's trendy Condesa neighborhood, and they say, yes, it's true. He was the model.
Yo que sepa, no.
But at the park nearby, 82-year-old Marín de Loterri says, no way.
El Oscar es una cosa delgada, bien formada, elegante, ¿no?
De Loterri says the Oscar statue is thin, with a good shape, elegant. He says the Fernandez he remembers wasn't. But Emilio Fernandez was older when he lived in Mexico City and paunchier. And the story about him modeling for the Oscar statue, you'll find it on Wikipedia, hear it on public radio.
Those pecs, those thighs, those shoulders, they came from a real guy.
You can read it in legit books.
I first saw it in a history book by a Mexican film historian named Emilio Garcia Riera.
That's Charles Ramirez Berg, professor of film studies at the University of Texas at Austin. He says there was a community of Mexicans working in Hollywood in the 1920s, around the same time the Academy Awards began.
And there was a number of them. Dolores del Rio was there, her cousin Ramon Navarro, and they were both big stars. And among them was Emilio Fernandez.
Fernandez was an extra at the time. And Ramirez Berg says when MGM art director Cedric Gibbons was designing the statuette for the Academy Awards, his wife, Dolores del Rio, had an idea.
And the story is that Dolores del Rio referred him to Emilio Fernandez and said, oh, you should use Emilio for the model. He had this very athletic build. I mean, he looked just like Oscar. All of this could have happened.
I called up the Academy Awards Library here in L.A. They wouldn't give me an interview, but the librarian I spoke with said there's zero proof any of that happened. And she seemed pretty annoyed by the question. They've been getting it a lot lately. Laura Isabel Serna is a professor at USC and has studied Mexicans who worked in Hollywood in the 20s. She says, yeah, there's probably no hard evidence to back the story, but
I think it would be wonderful if it were true, because it would be another bit of evidence of the involvement of Mexicans in particular and Latinos more generally in American cinema during its most formative years.
Serna says she thinks the legend persists because Latinos want to know they're a part of American history, a part of Hollywood history, that they played a critical role.
And that story really hasn't been told. And Emilio El Indio Fernandez is part of that story.
At this year's Academy Awards, Mexico's Alfonso Cuarón has been nominated for Best Director and Best Picture for Gravity. If he wins, I wonder if he'll thank the man who introduced Mexican filmmaking to the world and maybe even posed for that golden statuette. Shireen Marisol Meraji, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. China's leader, Xi Jinping, has made a crackdown on corruption a centerpiece of his administration. He's vowed to root out corruption from the bottom to the top, or to use his expression, to go after the tigers as well as the flies. When it comes to corrupt, high-ranking officials, there's a reliable source for tips: scorned mistresses. Some have even taken to shaming their lovers on social media, and the scandals have made international headlines. That got us wondering, who are these women? It turns out there's a whole mistress culture in China. These young women are professionals. Some get a very handsome salary for what they do. According to reporter James Palmer, if high-rolling businessmen and government officials don't have a mistress, they don't get respect. Palmer lives in Beijing and has written about mistress culture in China. He says it's like the mafia culture portrayed in Goodfellas. Saturday nights are for wives, but Friday nights are for mistresses.
You have events for your wives, but you also have these events where you're expected to bring a woman. And if you don't bring a woman, you're seen as not being a real man. And what begins as a commercial sexual relationship transitions into what the men see as an emotional one. And the woman, I think, sometimes they see it as purely business. Sometimes it takes on emotional meaning for them, too.
Give us some historical context here. How did keeping a mistress become commonplace?
Traditionally, China, of course, had various forms of polygamy. You could have multiple wives, and you expected at a certain level to have multiple wives. So in some ways, this is mirroring traditional Chinese habits. In others, it's just that when you get powerful men in a patriarchal society, they're going to set up women of their own.
Anthropologist Chun Chun Zhang knows firsthand what women go through to become mistresses. She spent 2 years studying sex workers in China. To gain their trust, she herself worked as a hostess in karaoke bars, which in this context are essentially brothels. Zheng didn't offer sexual services to clients, but the other hostesses did.
In the hostessing world, being a mistress is one step up. It's one of the dreams for many of the hostesses to be kept as mistresses. So at the first meeting, usually in the karaoke bars, the women will try all kinds of activities to achieve immediate intimacy. For instance, they will sing romantic songs. They will touch the man back and chest, and resting their heads on the man's shoulders, sing songs when gazing at the man's eyes. They will sit on the laps of the man and so on and so forth. And it was very common that the regular clients would propose keeping them as mistresses.
Zheng told me that for these women, hostessing was a way out of the bottom rung of society. And becoming a mistress is a ticket to the top.
Usually, the clients were responsible for all of the women's living expenses, entertainment fees and amenities, and plus a handsome monthly amount that the women could put into her own bank accounts.
Mistresses can make a ton of money. Zheng encountered mistresses who owned businesses, multiple homes, and various investments. But it's still sex work, and women working in karaoke bars have to deal with police raids, gangsters, abusive clients, and the daily threat of assault. Zheng said the hostesses in karaoke bars come from rural areas where life is rough to begin with.
These are rural women, and they came from the countryside to the city looking for jobs because of the intolerable poverty that was engendered by the decades of biased government policies against rural people.
The policy Zheng is talking about is the household registration system. It basically makes rural migrants into second-class citizens in the city.
Without urban resident permits, rural migrants are denied subsidized housing, healthcare, employment, children's education, and other benefits that are only associated with urban residence permits. The women that I study with, they had to pay monthly fees just to be able to reside in the city temporarily and legally. Almost every hostess in my research, they started out kind of at the bottom rung of society. So among the jobs available to them, the hostessing kind of offer opportunity for them to escape.
You've talked about some women, they're doing fairly well financially. They're able to take care of themselves and their families and run their own lives. But how typical is that? How much are these women empowered or how much are they just being exploited?
The reality is it's a murky relationship. It's not pure empowerment. It's not pure victimization or exploitation. It's somewhere in between. I had to caution people against thinking this in extremely black and white terms because for the women, their previous life as domestic workers, as waitresses, the man could use their body freely and can rape them anytime they want it. But sex work gave the women power. The women could sit there and the men have to pay just to see them, just to look at them, just to sit next to them. That's a lot of power.
But the public scandals involving mistresses have made for bad press. And James Palmer says some in power are trying to portray mistress culture as a cause of corruption rather than a symptom.
The government has pinned its image on being anti-corruption, and anti-corruption is linked to the idea of cracking down on vice, cracking down on drinking and gambling and sex work. And the government tries quite hard to push the idea that the mistresses cause the corruption rather than that the corruption causes the mistresses.
Has that notion taken hold, you know, among typical people in China?
I don't think it has, no. And I think fundamentally the public understands that this is a distraction and that the officials are the ones who are powering the mistress economy in the first place.
But Palmer is quick to point out that the anti-vice crackdown has focused on poor and seedy red light districts, the street working prostitutes, not the higher class karaoke hostesses or the mistresses living in luxury apartments. James Palmer lives in Beijing. You can read his article online at Aeon Magazine. Chunchun Zheng's book about the women in karaoke bars is called Red Lights, The Lives of Sex Workers in Post-Socialist China. Xavier Ruffin was excited for the 2007 premiere of Mad Men. Ruffin was a young graphic designer, and here was a show about his world.
I wanted to be a fan of it when it first came out. I just had my own personal differences, not liking the way that blacks were represented in their universe. I just couldn't get over it.
Instead of getting over it, he decided to create his own series, Mad Black Men.
Welcome to the Colored Marketing Department.
The new web series just premiered on the video sharing site Dailymotion. In the famous animated opening sequence to Mad Men, a silhouetted figure walks into an office which falls apart, pieces tumbling to the ground.
I just took a different approach to it and said, okay, so if the furniture falls down, someone has to clean it back up because every episode it falls down again. So one of our characters, Rufus, who is both the janitor and Colored Campaign's accountant.
What the?
He comes in and cleans up the mess, and he has a little quip to say every time.
I ain't cleaning this up twice.
Mad Men, of course, takes place in the world of Sterling Cooper and focuses on the lead character, Don Draper.
Our world is kind of like a parallel universe of sorts. So we're at Sterling Copper, that's Sterling without the G, and our protagonist is Ron Rapper, who's a hotshot ad executive making a name for himself in the New York scene. It's just that when he shows up to places, people are thrown off by the fact that he is non-white.
There was a misprint in the ad. We already have a custodian, thank you.
I'm sorry, you may have misunderstood me. I am here for the more lucrative position.
Security, this is Judy. You're needed on the 21st floor. Yeah, thank you.
Wait a minute.
We should explain how this is set up because this is not sort of like a Funny or Die kind of web parody. You do it with sort of high production values. It looks like it could be of that time period. And there are jokes there, but it's generally played kind of straight.
Yeah, it's more of a dramedy than it is like a Nick Gunn 33 and a third type of parody, because I feel like that's what's really popular on the internet right now. What I wanted to do is kind of cater to people who were interested in Mad Men, and I wanted to give them a different lens to look at that universe through. I did want to be a bit funny, maybe a little bit more silly than what Mad Men is, just to admit that we're poking fun at something.
Which brings us to the world of the Mad Black Men. Basically, we have the main character, Ron Rapper, who's brought in to head the Colored Marketing Department. And they basically work out of a broom closet.
Yes, this is true. Basically, they're working on what this ad agency feels are minority-specific clientele. So the first client that they're working with is Mississippi Melons.
I want you to make the lips and the nose a lot bigger because right now our character isn't black enough.
So they're working on these racially insensitive campaigns that are being handed down to them by just racially insensitive bosses.
Now, Matt Weiner, who created Mad Men, he's been criticized for not having more black people on the show. He said that basically there were no black people in advertising back then, and there still aren't to this day. How do you respond to that?
There are black people in advertising. There have been black people in advertising. There isn't a great amount of representation, but we do exist, and we are here.
So on the show, on the Mad Men show in recent seasons, there's been a bigger role for Dawn, the black woman who's the secretary of Don Draper. But there's been nobody of color on the creative side. Who are some of the black advertising creatives that you look up to?
All right. Well, the first person that comes to mind is George Olden, who was a very high-profile figure in the 1960s. He actually designed the Clio Award that Don wins in season 4.
Huh.
And, like, he won way more than Don ever won.
Wow.
Caroline Jones, whose story actually mirrors Peggy Olson. She was a secretary who became a copywriter who ended up owning her own firm. So, yeah, there's more than just a few people of color that were working and operating at a high capacity during the Mad Men era.
So The final season of Mad Men is going to be kicking off in April, but you've just got started on Mad Black Men. So where are you going to go from here? Where do you want to take this?
Well, I can't divulge those secrets just yet, but we do have right now a 5-season arc planned out. We've been looking into different real-life figures that we could model Ron's career trajectory after. Ron could have a great career. Or Ron could go the wayside, because you never know as a black man. it's real. Anything could happen at any time.
Xavier Ruffin is a graphic designer and the creator of a new web spoof called Mad Black Men. Thanks for your time today. Great talking with you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's time for the new and the next. Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Aussie. Each week he joins us to talk about what's new and what's next. Welcome back, Carlos.
Arun, good to see you in person this time.
Nice to have you actually here in the studio with us.
I like it. I like being in L.A.
So Mardi Gras is coming up on Tuesday. And well, let's start off. Here's a little Mardi Gras music with a particularly Mardi Gras problem.
Ain't no place to be on Mardi Gras Day.
And you're hearing right, he's saying there ain't no place to pee on Mardi Gras Day, which it is a problem. It's a crowded place, not a lot of public bathrooms, but there's a technological fix in the works?
Indeed, there is. You know, more than a million people show up at Mardi Gras, more rest than anything for public urination. And so, of course, two young millennials show up and say, we've got an idea. It's called Air P&P. And, of course, it's a little bit of a play on Airbnb, the very successful business in which people rent out rooms in their homes to travelers. But what they say is, look, a lot of people need a bathroom. There are not a lot of public facilities. Porta potties are fewer in supply. And so would you be willing to rent out access to your porcelain god, you know, during Mardi Gras for a little penny? So they've created an app which just launched a week ago and is doing incredibly well. So how do you like that for a little New Orleans genius?
So you go and you pay, I'm assuming, to use the facilities, and then do you rate it like an Uber car?
Without a doubt, all the good stuff's in there in the proper sharing economy. So you pay a buck or two or three, or if it's high demand, who knows what you could end up paying. And it's actually really interesting to think about how that could spread to other places where there are big festivals. You know, who knows?
Now, I can see the demand for this, but it'd be hard for me to imagine wanting to open my bathroom to a Mardi Gras reveler.
It might
charge a premium for that.
You know, yeah, it makes you wonder a little bit, and we could have all sorts of interesting interactions between people, right? And bathroom cleanliness is always an issue for any public facility, so we'll see how long this lasts. But certainly creative, huh? A little bold, a little interesting.
So another new technology, this one is still in the testing phase, though. The kids at MIT have come up with a different kind of electronic book.
No doubt about it. So a trio said that books are often about sparking emotion, stimulating all sorts of feelings. And so they said, what if we help that along a little bit? And of course, they're at MIT, so it involves technology. And so they've basically added a book and a vest. And involved in the vest in the book are certain sensors and even kind of a little heart stimulator so that if the character in the book starts to feel sad, maybe you feel a little cold, a little sad. if the character is under stress, you know, all of a sudden, you know, the book may vibrate or your vest may vibrate. It's kind of the natural successor to what's going on with video games.
Huh. And I can see that's just the sort of thing that I imagine the kids at the MIT lab's working on.
Right. Yeah, of course. Sensory fiction. But here's one of the things, Arun, I thought was very interesting. They've only created a prototype. They say they're not taking it commercial because more than anything at the moment, at least, they say they want to spark debate about this question. And certainly already, if you look at some of the comments that we got on our site, we certainly had people who said, well, that's dumb. Why, you know, the whole point of being an author is that you successfully stimulate emotion. Why do we want someone else to play with it? But certainly is a conversation, even in surround sound movies and movies that have some kind of smell as part of it in certain parts of the world.
Right.
People are toying with that.
Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Aussie. You can explore all the stories we talked about at npr.org/newandnext. Carlos, thanks again.
Arun, really good to see you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. The Oscars are covered from pretty much every angle imaginable. There are over 3 hours of red carpet interviews before the ceremony even starts. For those of you who like a healthy dose of snark, Joan Rivers is already on the fashion beat, and the live blogging has already begun. But there's an amazing perspective on the action that gets missed. There's a brief moment backstage, after a performer has won an award, and before they step in front of more photographers, that's seen by almost nobody but stagehands and our next guest. Anthony Breznican is a senior writer for Entertainment Weekly. He's been covering the Oscars for 14 years, and he's been in that spot backstage. We asked him on the show to peel back the curtain for us.
Everybody says they're backstage if they're not in the audience, but this is literally where the scenery is moving on and coming off. It's the nexus point for everything that's happening on stage.
And is it just incredibly busy as things are queuing up for the next award, the next presenters?
It is, because people come back to hang out and greet the host. You know, you'll see Jack Nicholson floating around back there having a cigarette with a bunch of crew guys.
Are you sure that was a cigarette?
Yeah, it was. I'm sure. But if you're back there, you're like up close and personal with everyone who normally would be, you know, at arm's length. And so you get to see some really human moments.
So what have been some of the more memorable backstage moments for you? This is after the people have got their awards and they come backstage and you see some of the real reaction.
Oh, absolutely. I remember last year, Jennifer Lawrence won for Silver Linings Playbook, and mm-hmm. she kind of famously stumbled up the stairs and
right.
gave this very charming speech telling everybody, oh, you're just standing up because I fell. She was really nervous and unsure of how that played when she came backstage. And I remember all she wanted was a donut. They have these Krispy Kreme donuts on a little card table back there for the crew. And like, I remember she's walking with her Oscar. She's in the least glamorous place in the world in this beautiful gown, these kind of like stone walls and dank shadows. And she just lunges for this box and is like flipping it open. And the only remaining donuts have like the chocolate icing on them. And I think she looked at those and she went, I'm not getting that all over me before I go to the photo room before 100 photographers, and she ditched it, but she really wanted that donut. I just remember thinking that was really kind of sweet.
That's willpower.
Mm-hmm.
Now what happens with the bigger awards? It's the recipient from the past year presents to whoever's winning the current year, right?
Yeah, they're sort of like this spirit guide for whoever the winners are, the ones who won last year. And it's reversed. The best actress last year presents best actor this year.
Okay. And so do you get to see what the interaction is like between these two people, these Hollywood stars?
I think that's the most moving thing that I get to witness backstage. A few years ago when Marion Cotillard won for La Vie en Rose,
right.
she's this tiny bird-like person. She's very small. Forrest Whitaker had won the year before Best Actor for The Last King of Scotland.
Not bird-like.
He's not bird-like. He is huge. He is tall. He's big. He has hands that are like baseball mitts. And as they walk off stage, she just begins crying. She's shaking. She just seizes onto him, just latches on and hugs him. And he's very gently like patting her head, patting her back. And I just remember her saying like, I feel so disoriented and lost. And he was saying, yeah, that's what's magic about it. That's what you're supposed to feel. And I've seen that time and again. You know, Jeff Bridges, when he won, you think, you know, the dude, he's pretty laid
right,
back.
Yeah.
Kate Winslet presented to him, and she came back like a stage mom, like Mama Rose. She's like, okay, he needs to get to the thank you cam to thank all the people he forgot to thank on stage. And he's like, I don't even know what a thank you cam is. And she was directing him back there.
Are there some that are better spirit guides than others, some that maybe not so great at guiding?
Yes, that's definitely true. I remember when Sandra Bullock won for The Blind Side, and she does the same thing they all do, walks off stage and is mm-hmm. plunged into darkness after being in probably the brightest spot on the planet at that moment. And she turns to Sean Penn, who had just given her the trophy, and she goes, well, what do I do? Where do I go now? And he kind of put his hands in his pocket and shrugs and goes, I don't know. And he walks away.
Oh.
And she's just sort of standing there like, you know, what now? And you know who came to her rescue?
Who?
Forrest Whitaker happened to be back there presenting. And Sandra Bullock says, you know, what I want is a cheeseburger. And Forrest Whitaker says, okay, well, just off of Orange outside the theater, you head down past Hollywood Boulevard, there's an In-N-Out burger. And he's, I mean, this guy, if you win an Oscar, you want Forrest Whitaker there.
They should have stationed Forrest Whitaker backstage
exactly.
and just leave him there to help
exactly.
people out.
Exactly. Paging Forrest Whitaker. We have a runner. So
finally, you had a kind of a wonderful backstage moment with the late, great Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah. Shortly before the Oscars, I'd encountered him at Sundance, and we had a part of like a meet and greet dinner for the movie The Savages. And my wife mm-hmm. and I sat and talked to him. And it was one of those moments where you're no longer an interviewer and a subject, where you just end up having just kind of a friendly conversation. And we were thinking about having kids, and he already had a child of his own. And we were asking, like, you know, things you ask people who have young children when you're planning to, how do you manage it? And he was just like eager to like tell us what he thought we should do with our personal life. He had lots of parenting advice, like, no, just do it, you know, don't talk yourself out of it. It was really great advice, and I saw him at the Oscars, and I'm out on the sort of grimy loading dock phoning in my story. And he sees me, and he kind of comes over. He's smoking a cigarette, and he's reading little scraps of paper that have his introductory speech to present the award. And he kind of points at me, and he's like, I know you. Where do I know you from? And I told him, we had this little conversation. He's like, right. What have you decided? Are you having the kids or not? It was one of those surreal moments where I was like, well, Philip Seymour Hoffman, we're still thinking about it. And he kind of shook his head. He just looked like so contemptuous of this. He's like, no, you just have to commit. Your priorities will clarify.
And I know you're a parent now, so I know you took that advice.
I did. My daughter, who was first in line, is 4 and a half.
Anthony Bresnahan is a senior writer for Entertainment Weekly. Anthony, thank you.
Glad to be here.
For the week ending March 2nd, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Becky Sullivan, Daniel Hajek, Lina Anwar, and Francesca Fenzi. Our intern is Stephen Jackson. Patrick Murray is technical director with technical support from Marcia Caldwell and Leo Delagula. Mathoni Maturi is our senior editor, and Phil Harrell is standing in for Steve Lichtai as senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.